described the way bodies were flung out from the structure during its nosedive to the planet's surface. And, in very pragmatic terms, when he described the radius around the structure in which corpses had so far been recovered. And that was just the first pass. The closer they got, the more unsettling the visuals were. From the still smoking fires to the imploded buildings, the crumbled remains of their gold plating reflecting the licks of flames.
By estimates, we have recovered a third of the bodies so far.
Were there any survivors?
Yes. Luck was on their side. Our analysis team wants to discuss their circumstances with them to see if they can identify a pattern, some type of safety parameter we can build into our infrastructure.
He looked down, his green skin turning more ashen as his eyes closed.
But most of them refused to talk about it.
Look, Ventress said, interrupting the discussion. Stop the shuttle.
The flight paused, hovering in midair. Ventress took out a scope, then stood by the cockpit.
There it is, she said. Come here, Kenobi.
What is it?
She handed over the scope and pointed at an angle off the flight path.
Obi-Wan brought the scope to his eyes, the target area already highlighted in a bright green box within the display. The scope zoomed in, its internal computer interpolating details about the damage so fast that Obi-Wan couldn't digest it all. But the visual highlight was enough. This clearly was the remains of a strut built to secure the city block between spires, a charred burst indicating the center of an explosion.
The blast points,
she said, and as if by design, five further green boxes lit up, each framing clear burn marks.
How many do you count?
Six. Six blast points, each precisely laid out with exact spacing and angles to one another, probably calculated by computer. The destruction on the shredded end of the massive strut blanketed over a lot of the finer evidence. But Obi-Wan had seen enough in his time, including his few weeks being around the clones, to understand that Ventress was right. And bounty hunters, pirates, mercenaries, while it remained possible that they could do something like this, the odds of that felt low, especially after Dex's report.
Six blast points, distributed specifically to maximize damage given the load on the strut.
I would consider this military precision. Wouldn't you?
Perhaps,
Obi-Wan said, one eye on IM in the front of the craft.
Droids can be precise as well.
That they can. Such an astute observation. I can see why they call you a master.
She turned to IM as well.
And this is just a single strut. Who knows what we'll find elsewhere?
Though an exhale of frustration fought to come out, Obi-Wan caught it, and instead offered the scope to Ventress in a controlled gesture.
This certainly requires more investigation. Indeed.
She took the scope back with a harsh tug that pulled on his fingers.
If there are no objections,
IM said,
I would like to land and show you the destruction on the surface level.
Please do. It is imperative that I see the entire range of destruction before I start my investigation. I promise I will get to the bottom of this. The shuttle chair creaked as Obi-Wan shifted in his seat to look directly at Ventress. Perhaps through mutual cooperation, we can find some common ground between our governments.
Cooperation?
Ventress settled back into her chair, legs crossed and arms folded. Light from outside reflected in the shuttle's cramped quarters, and Obi-Wan caught a glint of metallic reflection by her hip before she adjusted her cloak.
Certainly, if you can win me over.
Chapter 17. Anakin Skywalker.
Chancellor Palpatine paced in front of the group of standing Jedi Knights, Anakin on the far end.
"You are our greatest hope and our guardians," he said, Coruscant's infinite stream of building lights visible behind him through the window spanning the length of his office. "Particularly now, the Republic needs you more than ever. Fighting a growing enemy is a challenge, not just physically, but philosophically, morally. You represent the best chance for lasting peace throughout the galaxy. You are Jedi," Palpatine said, his voice taking on a grim sheen, as if the accumulated talking and tasks of the day wore him out. "Knights of the Republic." The group gave a mild, polite applause, a smattering of noise that barely rose above the sound of the ventilation. They each waited, the same group as yesterday, save for Cyrus Okund, who had already been assigned to join a clone battalion, fighting a sudden strike on Bracca, and Palpatine gestured out to the hallway. The short ceremony now concluded, the Jedi marched in pious single file, Palpatine receiving each one with a congratulations and thank you for defending peace and justice. Anakin was third from the end, and though he and the Chancellor enjoyed a less formal relationship, a guise of etiquette felt necessary here.
"Thank you, Chancellor," he said. "May the Force be with you."
"Master Skywalker, please do wait a minute," Palpatine said, pausing the line. "I need to speak with you about Master Kenobi's mission to Cato Ne Moidia."
"Yes, Chancellor," he said with a slight head bow, his voice as docile as a youngling acknowledging his teacher.
Durban Wen Herd gave the final acknowledgement of the group before shuffling out. Both Palpatine and Anakin watched her leave, waiting for the double doors to slide shut and seal them in the room alone.
"You are concerned about Obi-Wan?" Anakin said, as Palpatine walked over to the small tray of refreshments delivered for the brief meeting.
Outside the massive transparent steel window, Coruscant's sunset started to transition the day's oranges to purples while lines of speeder traffic whooshed by.
"Cuff?"
Palpatine asked, pouring himself a cup.
"Sure,"
Anakin said, thinking he could use a little perk before seeing Padme.
"A single shot of cream."
"There you are, my young friend,"
Palpatine said, putting a cup on the visitor's side of his broad desk.
"Sit down, sit down."
Palpatine eased into his elaborate chair with a slight groan, then sipped on the small white mug in his hand.
"Now, tell me, how is Jedi knighthood?"
Anakin took the cup, a blink of confusion on his face.
"I thought you wanted to talk about Obi-Wan's mission."
"I simply wanted to catch up,"
he said with a raised eyebrow.
"It is so rare these days to find time for quiet conversation, don't you think? But if you want to discuss Master Kenobi, I am happy to."
The right thing to say, the Jedi thing to say, would be to shrug it off and instead chat about the upcoming aid mission to Langston. But the Chancellor was no ordinary politician or Republic dignitary. He had been there for Anakin since his early days with the Jedi, seemingly always tuned in to Anakin's turbulent feelings. In moments of loneliness or frustration, Palpatine popped up in the timeliest manner. A chance hallway meeting or crossing paths at the landing platform. Or scenarios like this, when they would happen to be in a meeting together and Palpatine would find a way to grab a few extra minutes with Anakin. Not always with Calf, but sometimes. That open hand of friendship always encouraged an honest conversation, the feeling that "how are you" was a true inquiry and not just a default greeting. Especially since they'd both been busy, the chaos of the war's quick escalation throwing them all over the galaxy. Not to mention the time spent on Naboo to get married.
"Has anything troubled you lately?" We haven't even had time to discuss the happenings of Geonosis.
Palpatine took a sip and shook his head.
How fast life changes these days.
Actually, Anakin started. The words formed in him, wanting to push out without any regard for secrecy, to tell someone besides Padme about the horrors of that night on Tatooine. Someone older, wiser, who clearly cared for his well-being. Someone who didn't judge. Which was why he couldn't tell any Jedi about it. Not even Obi-Wan.
Anakin, I may be a busy man, but for the next few minutes, I am here merely as your friend. You can tell me anything.
Polite creases formed around his mouth as Palpatine smiled.
Please feel free to confide in me about whatever concerns you. You have permission to be honest, and I will not judge. While I do work with the Jedi, I am not beholden to their rules.
Right before Geonosis, Anakin started before pausing, but it wasn't a hesitation. Instead, it was as if all of those feelings and memories competed to get out, causing a logjam in his throat. My mother died.
Palpatine's lips parted, his brow tilting in concern. My boy, I am so sorry for your loss.
She didn't just die. The words broke through, a storm raging with them. Flashes from that night flickered by. The way the lightsaber pierced the wall. The dance of the flame over his mother's cold, open eyes. The thump from the severed heads of the sand people hitting the ground. She was murdered. And I... Anakin stopped himself, letting it all formulate. Before that night, Anakin thought he knew pain. His first few days in the Jedi Order, the undying ache of missing his mother compounded with the sorrow of losing Qui-Gon Jinn. All of that magnified the way the Jedi seemed to talk and act with an intentional calm distance. Those dark times were a speck of dust compared with the endless desert of that night. That moment when his mother's body went limp, unable to finish her final word. Rage, despair, disbelief. None of those words aptly described the unseemly, primal explosion he felt in that moment. Even now, just thinking about it allowed such a beast to crack through his defenses until he took a steadying breath and pushed it back so words could form. I killed them. The Sand People. Unlike that moment in the Lars homestead, Anakin wasn't expelling grief through searing words and falling tears. This came out calm, tempered, equal parts admission and confirmation. They took her life, and I took theirs. Palpatine set his calf mug down with a clink, then reached over, the warmth of his palm resting over Anakin's mechanical one. Though the hand was made of wire and alloy, he felt the connection in ways so different from most of the moments in his life.
They killed your mother. Your mother, he said, his weathered voice slow and deliberate. Of course you wanted revenge. How could anyone not when facing such an injustice? It seems like simple mathematics to me.
No, this was not an admission. This was a validation. And he knew that the Chancellor would give it. Because he always understood in ways that the Jedi couldn't. As if reading Anakin's mind, Palpatine sat up and quickly asked the perfect question.
How many Jedi actually care about other people?
Anakin started with his reflexive response. Attachment is forbidden.
I know the dogma, but be honest. Let's take, say...
Behind the Chancellor, a Republic cruiser emerged from below the window line.
hovering upward until its ion drives came alive in a burst, powering the ship into the sky. Master Windu. He is perhaps the Order's greatest warrior, most powerful force adept. But do you really think he cares about people?
Like a button pushed in his mind, Anakin saw Mace's glare, heard his condescending monotone speech, felt the air of judgment that naturally came with him. He knew the Jedi Master would do anything to complete the mission, to dedicate himself to seeing justice in the Republic. But did he care about anyone?
Not, Anakin said slowly, in the same way you or I do.
You see? Master Windu can go on for hours about shatter points, but perhaps that lack of empathy is his very own shatter point.
Palpatine gave a weary grin, his eyes offering an empathy that Anakin so rarely felt in his life.
You care, Anakin. You have an immense heart. Don't let the Jedi take it from you. Your heart makes you a better person. It makes you a stronger person.
Though the words didn't directly reflect the tale of the Sun Dragon, it touched on it just enough that Anakin pictured his mother sitting on the edge of his bed. Had he been alone, not with the Chancellor, not with Padme, not with Obi-Wan, he may have cracked. But he wouldn't let himself right now. And instead, he pushed all those feelings inside.
I'm worried about Obi-Wan, he blurted out, changing the subject to the most obvious choice.
Palpatine laughed quietly and picked his mug back up. You see? You are a person who cares.
I should be going with him. How can they send me to escort an A-drop off when Obi-Wan is going alone into enemy territory?
Ah, don't call them the enemy. Cato Ne Moidia is neutral, after all.
Palpatine took an extra long sip of his drink, the pause long enough for a new storm to gather in Anakin's mind.
The enemy. Of course they were. All framing of neutrality and politics disappeared, and instead, all he thought of was Naboo a decade ago. Though he rarely came face to face with any Neimoidians, he saw their machines of war up close. And Padme, she had nearly lost her life, her planet, in a desperate quest for liberty. If there was an enemy, it would be them.
Despite their ties to Newt Gunray and his ties to the Separatists,
Palpatine said with a sigh. Anakin tried to temper his feelings, but the mere mention of Newt Gunray fanned the flames.
But you are right. Master Kenobi should have brought you, unofficially, as backup.
If you thought so, Anakin asked, why didn't you say so?
The question was blurted out in a way that he immediately regretted, his feelings getting the better of him. Palpatine didn't seem to take offense, and instead smiled again as a response.
A valid question. You see, I only have the authority to approve the framework of the mission. Perhaps if the Jedi and the military were further integrated, I might have more say. The execution of it comes down to the Jedi themselves. They set the mission parameters.
Count Dooku set the mission parameters, Anakin said, his feelings settling.
Mission parameters can always be changed in politics, military missions, or life, and the truly wise know when to make those changes.
Bah!
He straightened up, finishing his calf.
I have taken enough of your time. Your first lead assignment as a Jedi Knight is tomorrow, is it not?
Yes, and initiates are going to be on it.
Anakin decided not to finish his drink. His hands rested across his lap, a formal pose as he tried to ground himself from the whiplash of emotions.
It's concerning.
I understand. I personally requested that change. Not just on your mission, but many missions.
Younglings aren't ready.
That may be true.
Palpatine tented his fingers as he swiveled his chair sideways. The Chancellor looked outside, the color of sunset tinting his face.
But this war may last longer than we hope. And as the younglings grow into Padawans, they must feel comfortable around the clones. We must prepare for every possibility. I hope they do not have to face the horrors of war. But I would rather them be prepared than not. Wouldn't you?
Yes, of course, Anakin said reflexively, though doubt still tugged at him. Obi-Wan had spoken with concern about lines blurring between the Jedi Order and the military. Bringing younglings into the mix seemed to push that even further.
Anakin, you should set that aside for one evening. Rest up, he said, and enjoy your time before your first mission. It is a milestone. You should be proud. I know I am.
They stood up in unison, then walked slowly back to the entryway, as they'd done possibly 100 times now since Qui-Gon brought Anakin to Coruscant.
Do you have any special plans to commemorate your achievements?
Plans? Whether or not Padme came up with anything concrete to do, he'd find out soon. The specifics of the plans didn't matter, though he hoped they'd avoid politics on their final night. What mattered was spending time with his wife before the galaxy tore them apart yet again. Someday, he might get used to it. Or someday, maybe they wouldn't have to do this dance anymore.
It will be quiet, Anakin said as the large double door slid open. I plan on meditating.
Of course,
Palpatine responded with the same reassuring smile Anakin had seen for the past decade.
As a Jedi Knight should.
Chapter 18. Obi-Wan Kenobi.
The rest of the day played out with a frustrating level of bureaucracy during the up-close investigation on the planet's surface. Obi-Wan putting his tools to good use, all while the mysterious Asajj Ventress stayed close by, shadowing him in her hood and cloak. She offered little input during that entire time, stoically observing. He'd considered asking her opinion on debris trajectory from the explosion or the decay of lingering chemical compounds, but it didn't seem necessary. She clearly came with an agenda, even if that agenda only involved trying to intimidate Obi-Wan into a mistake of some sort. He took his recordings and scans, made his analyses, and brought them back to his quarters, acting as if nothing bothered him. After that came a diplomatic reception, as if the context of a societal-shattering disaster never took place. Obi-Wan sat and enjoyed a well-prepared meal, local cuisine, courtesy of Zara's finest professional chefs. Yet despite the mix of exquisitely cooked dishes and fancy table linens, the conversations continued around matters of the bombing. A desperate plea for answers wrapped up in the guise of a dinner party. All the while, Ventress kept a measured distance from Obi-Wan, always seated 3 or 4 chairs away. But when she spoke with others, her eyes seemingly never wavered from tracking him. And even as he retired to his quarters for the evening, he stretched out with the Force, scanning for the presence of someone following him the entire time. It didn't happen, and he let himself indulge in a meditative rest for an hour. A mental and physical restoration to better fuel his inner discipline for the task ahead. Scanners hung in pouches on his belt, and he draped himself in his long cloak to better blend in with the dark, foggy evening. Then he stepped out the window, a simple escape guided by the Force. Shortly after, he acquired a small craft through persuasion slightly aided by Force trickery. That level of rule-bending didn't sit well with him, but his resources were limited, particularly since Ventress had confiscated his credit chips, and it was imperative that zero electronic records tie the Republic back into this. Without physical currency, he instead worked with the realm of simpler minds. The personal vehicle lacked the comforts of a Nemoidian shuttle, but it got the job of flying him down to the disaster zone done. Not that the data he'd collected earlier was bad, but given Ventress's constant presence, a deeper look at the situation was necessary to verify his findings and collect new data. In the dark, the thick fog wove in between the fallen urban sprawl to create a near-black atmosphere, only interrupted by some still smoldering fires and the occasional clusters of orange glow from bioluminescent oil oozing from Cato Nemoidia's native surface trees. Obi-Wan let the Force guide him, his instincts pulling him toward blast points and debris, taking samples to refine calculations that would hopefully provide deeper insight into what really happened. Whether a stunt or coincidence, Ventress's move with the scope earlier today focused suspicion on the Republic, and it was up to him to dispel any assumptions. He examined the area for well over an hour on his own, the constant data from scanners creating a continuous refinement of the Republic simulation on his datapad. He'd unfolded his chemical scanner, the Frick alloy case attached and hidden in his quarters, then began identifying the gaseous compound from still noxious fumes when something interrupted his concentration. Or someone. Movement, quick, nearly silent, but enough for it to cause a detectable blip in the Force. Obi-Wan curled the scanner shut, then slipped it into his belt pouch, though he remained crouched, staying still to avoid creating any sound. While his ears picked up only the wind and the howl of local wildlife, he needed more, and he took the calculated risk of turning with controlled movements, keeping his weight steady to not kick out any flecks of gravel at his feet. He pulled out Jedi macro binoculars, a smaller scope than what Ventress used earlier. Enough to easily carry around, but without the computational capabilities found in her equipment. The internal screens came to life, gears whirring as he zoomed and panned to find the source. Then he saw it. Or rather, her. A Nemoidian female. The tall frame and long fingers gave it away, along with a general sense of identity detected through the Force. But not a typical member of the Trade Federation, not the usual stately, regal robes and headdresses, and not the standard helmet and shoulder armor of the guards, or the bulky armor of Nemoidian heavy troops. This silhouette appeared somewhere in between, light enough for movement but plated enough to withstand heavy fire. It was a commando's outfit, built for a balance among movement, stealth, and protection. She held a small device in her hands, possibly very similar to Obi-Wan's scanners and tools, though she worked with a soldier-like methodical cadence, completely different from the strange sense of competition he got from Asajj Ventress. She moved the device up and down, focused on a single point, before leaping up onto a ledge, landing with a balance that held steady even with the ledge crumbling away. This repeated several more times, an impressive nimbleness to her movements despite clearly not being force-powered. The figure stood up, jolting with a forward purpose that made Anakin seem like a lumbering tank in comparison. She climbed and vaulted over cracked structures. A gracefulness to her swift movements made extra impressive given that a large sniper rifle was strapped to her back, and her finger tapped what might have been a comlink at the side of her head. Obi-Wan panned the macro binoculars to follow, wondering where she might be going, when the snap of a twig caught his attention. He stood in one movement, buckling the macro binoculars to his belt while drawing his lightsaber. The blue blade sprang to life with a snap hiss, its cool glow illuminating the space. Obi-Wan stretched out, sensing all of the echoes of life around him, filtering out the insects and wildlife to get to... He turned, no longer needing the scope to see the figure from earlier on the second story of a half-destroyed building. Except rather than scanning materials or debris, she now knelt in firing position, her sniper rifle trained on him. Obi-Wan had raised his lightsaber into a defensive position when he heard something new behind him. Freeze, Jedi.
Chapter 19. Anakin Skywalker.
An aid mission. Anakin kept telling himself that over and over. He was supposed to be on an aid mission with the 302nd Battalion, arranging logistics with Commander Theo for distribution to an embattled mining district on the planet Langston, just outside the Augustus Nebula. Langston's mining industry produced a full gamut of materials, but the abundance of Nyx made it a coveted resource for shipyards, and it was no surprise that the droid armies tried to seize it early on in the war. With devastation hitting the biggest cluster of mining towns on the northeast section of its largest continent, Anakin should have been thinking about maximizing efficiency. Some areas would need food. Some areas would need BACTA and first aid. Some would need shelter and infrastructure. And others simply needed help rebuilding, along with defensive preparations should the Separatists strike again. So many of the tasks required mind-numbing repetition, from cataloging the cargo manifest, to reviewing drop points, to planning distribution teams based on environmental hazards. Lists upon lists, all to handle the endless crates of medical tools, rations, and other supplies needed for a region that suffered an early major battle of the war. Yet Anakin cursed Durban for offering to take the lead with Theo. It seemed like a selfless gesture on her part, given that several thousand supply crates required sorting into shipment groups, but now he realized that she'd tricked him. Because no amount of training prepared him for this. Trapped in the tunnel of light speed on a blistering path from Coruscant to Langston, Anakin stood there in front of the worst mistake of his life. Four younglings waited in front of him, an endless barrage of Master Skywalker echoing off the walls of the cargo hold. He was supposed to be on an aid mission, not trying to control the sheer, unrelenting chaos of babysitting. Hold on! I can't answer all the questions at once! This was worse than the morning at the Jedi Temple. In the temple, a sense of decorum existed, the venue providing the familiarity of rules and guidelines. But here, on a ship with only two newly promoted Jedi Knights, and a bunch of clones not trained for helping, four younglings might as well have been 60, a rapid-fire blend of so many voices repeatedly yelling, "Master Skywalker!" at once. Even finding a centering rhythm within the Force seemed impossible amid the noise and tugs in so many different directions, a confusion so very different from the battlefield. The sound of a lightsaber burst past the voices, a green training blade sparking to life. "No, we're not using those right now," Anakin said. "I'm going to collect all the lightsabers if anyone ignites another one."
"Show us your lightsaber! How many battle droids have you destroyed?"
"I bet he almost killed Count Dooku himself."
Anakin wanted to bury his head in his hands and scream, all of the discipline he'd trained into himself melting away at the sheer illogical nature of younglings. Somehow they got the younger batch of younglings on this trip, all just old enough to be corralled on a cruiser. With proper supervision, of course. Except, weren't there five younglings? One youngling's training lightsaber lit up, leading to a push and a skirmish and yelling, all in the seconds Anakin took to scan for the other youngling, the older Zabrak girl.
Stop!
Anakin yelled. A lightsaber is not a toy. The youngest of the bunch, a Ferrario named Kanis Dav, stood with trembling lips, tears welling up.
What I mean is, Anakin said, his voice calm, this weapon is your life. You have to treat it with respect.
Show us! Yeah, show us!
He sighed, giving in to the fact that he wouldn't be winning any teaching awards for this lesson. Okay, look. Everyone stand in a line over there and don't move. His lightsaber burst into full view, the shimmering blue blade longer and brighter than the youngling's training versions. It is a weapon of precision and elegance. It requires the utmost control. Now what? He was improvising about lightsabers, and he'd run out of things to say unless he went into the wiring schematics. This really was where Durbin Wenherd would have done a much better job than him, because she used two short Shoto blades. Her training involved a unique form of lightsaber combat that emphasized dagger-like slicing and acrobatics, a demonstration that would be much more entertaining than Anakin's technique. Then, an idea popped into his head. And when you can really control it, you can do this. He passed the lightsaber from his mechanical hand to his organic one. The trick he had in mind, too risky to do without feeling completely in sync. His hand opened up, fingers letting go, but the lightsaber remained. He took a step back, a deep connection with the Force enabling a hold on the weapon as muscle and nerves were grabbing it, and it floated in midair.
Whoa!
The younglings cried out. Why didn't he try this earlier? Anakin dipped a finger and it twirled left, then another finger and it twirled right. It then lifted up and down, a colorful light show in the form of the legendary weapon of the Jedi Knights. And he even added a somersault over the floating lightsaber before sucking it back into the grip of his mechanical hand. Then he shut it down. That was something he could trust that hand with. The younglings applauded, raving with, "Did you see?" and "How'd he do that?" and other exclamations. That seemed to win them all over for now, except he was still missing the Zabrak girl. He looked all around the cargo bay and between the crates and passing clones. He spied her. She'd been there all along, just sitting in the corner by herself. Younglings, he said, now I would like you to meditate on what you just saw for, 10 minutes.
Ah!
They groaned, but as a group, they collectively sat and closed their eyes. Maybe simple tricks were all that was necessary to get them to listen. If not, then Durbin would have to grab the spotlight for the next round. She owed him that. As quiet set in, Anakin's ability to concentrate returned for the first time since stepping in front of the younglings. But with that focus came an odd sensation. And in fact, he realized that he should have recognized where the Zabrak girl was all along. Because the vacuum and the force that he'd sensed throughout the temple circled all around her. Are you all right? He said, approaching the Zabrak. She opened her eyes and the vacuum disappeared, the currents of the Force resuming their normal flow. He should have remembered her name. They'd all been introduced hours earlier. But he went with honesty here, kneeling down in front of her. Hey, it's okay. You can talk to me. I'm sorry, but I've forgotten your name.
Mil Alabath.
Mil, I'm Anakin. Is something the matter? Hyperspace can make you nauseous the first few times if you're new to it.
It's not that.
she said, shaking her head.
It's something else.
Mill appeared to be the Zabrak equivalent of his age when he left Tatooine. Perhaps a tiny bit older, and likely past the age of simple force tricks being impressive.
Well,
Anakin said, we're going to be here a while, so if there's something on your mind, you can tell me. Now, this was improvising. Handling younglings of any type was as foreign to Anakin as Padme's political negotiations, but he couldn't contain his instinctive urge to care, to try to help. Mill started. She huffed out a sigh, then looked at his eyes.
You promise you won't get mad?
I promise. You can count on me. Mill leaned forward, close enough that Anakin felt her breath.
I don't know if I belong in the Jedi Order.
Anakin took in several slow and controlled breaths, so many things flashing through his mind. Qui-Gon's certainty in stating, here's the Chosen One, before the Jedi Council. The peace parade on Naboo, standing proud with his newly shorn Padawan hair. Endless bickering with Obi-Wan. Padme. So many thoughts about Padme. Tatooine. The Sand People. His mother. All of those things tied intrinsically with this decision to leave home and join the Order. And yet through it all, he too never felt like he quite belonged. And this was the first time anyone had ever said it. Mill's breath quickened, a tremble coming to her voice.
I'm just kidding. Forget I said.
I understand, Anakin said in a controlled, calm voice. Because he did. Tell me more, youngling.
I feel the Force,
she said, her hand balled into a fist.
But it's overwhelming. I know the Order can do good. I know the Jedi are guardians of peace. But...
She turned, Anakin now facing her tight black tail of hair.
But the war, the fighting, the violence. I feel all of that through the Force. I can't explain it, but it's too much. And I don't understand why the Jedi are peacekeepers and all of the other initiates can't wait to get their weapons. And we're in the battlefield with soldiers?
Justice sometimes requires a heavy hand.
But from the Jedi? I just...
She turned back to Anakin.
It doesn't feel right. The other day,
It's okay, youngling. You're not in trouble. I appreciate your honesty. What happened yesterday?
The gathering.
She bit down on her lip as if she replayed the events in her mind.
I was supposed to go. But the bombing at Cato Ne Moidia. I just couldn't think about lightsabers and crystals. I don't even want my lightsaber. I just want to help others. I don't...
Her eyes dropped for a second before they locked back onto his, as if her body required a confession.
I don't know if I want to feel the Force.
Suddenly, it all made sense. The vacuum in the Force, both yesterday and here. She wasn't in meditation. This youngling was trying to quiet the Force. Possibly even cut it off. Anakin knew. He recognized it because, for a very brief moment during his darkest, loneliest days, shortly after becoming a Padawan, with his peers lacking compassion for him, and Obi-Wan constantly flustered and his heart yearning for the comfort of his mother, a spike of anger shut him off from the Force. For a flash, it did the trick. It tempered his feelings, it quieted his mind, it soothed his fears. But then it was gone. Not nearly enough. Because while that avoided connection, It also pushed him further into a corner. And it was at that moment he realized that he needed to reach into the Force, rather than avoid it. Anakin looked at the other younglings, still sitting in a line in meditative poses, though the occasional jabs and giggles came from them. Palpatine's words about getting the initiates used to war replayed in his mind. In front of him, Mill turned, Anakin sensing a cloud over her, an internal shame, likely for questioning the order. Anakin also understood that part all too well. I've always felt a little out of place. My entire life. Even with the Order.
You?
She looked at him, eyes wide. But aren't you the Chosen? Don't believe everything you hear. Anakin said with a laugh, though he groaned inside. Not again. Half the time people said it to him in awe, the other half in jest, and on occasion in condescension, usually from Mace Windu. No matter how much he succeeded, no matter how much he proved himself, things always seemed to come to that, and not in the way Qui-Gon intended. Qui-Gon saw it as a path for Anakin. Whether or not that played out, he didn't know. But everyone else seemed to think it was a title. Like a sports champion. He shook his head, going to a better place. My mother once told me, always believe in the strength of your heart. And she was right. Whatever things people said about me, their assumptions, it doesn't matter. What you believe in your heart is your path. When I questioned the Force, even disconnected from it, that is what brought me back. That is what brought me through. Anakin took her hand with his mechanical hand. She looked at the glove, a look of shock on her face that came and went. He understood. Not everyone knew about his new limb. I know how you must be feeling. That you don't fit in or your path feels elusive. That it's difficult to master your connection with the Force. But that's part of the journey. Your journey. And you will find General Skywalker. I'm sorry, he said to Mill before standing up. Captain Sparks patiently waited for him, helmet with bright yellow lines tucked under his arm. Yes, Sparks.
Sir, Commander Theo needs you on the bridge. Apparently the intended drop zone has been damaged to the point that we won't be able to land. We'll need to find someplace new.
Understood. I'll be right there. He turned to Mill, then looked at the younglings, the white-skinned Mon Calamari peeking at them with a single yellow eye.
Listen, controlling your link to the Force is something that takes time and practice. Some struggle with it more than others. But do me a favor.
What's that, Master?
Don't try to run away from the Force. Lean into it. Reach into it. Control it.
Anakin tried his best at a reassuring smile.
If I could learn to do it, so can you.
She nodded, though it wasn't clear whether his words really crystallized in her, at least not yet.
As for the war, the Jedi do a lot of good for the Republic. Sometimes aggressive negotiations are just as important as bringing medical supplies. I know that's confusing, but it's true. Both can benefit the galaxy. I understand you. I've been where you are. So be patient and we'll talk more later. All right?
Mill nodded, her features softening, Anakin emphasizing with the simple need for someone to listen.
But for now,
yes, Master?
If you really want to be handy,
Anakin pointed at the initiates, who pretended to meditate, but really kept poking at each other.
Take care of the younglings. You're the oldest.
But, hey. Anakin offered a smile, something to break the heavy mood.
You said you wanted to help others.
right?
Chapter 20. Rug Quornom.
Rug really, really hoped Kitar would not let the moment get the best of him. Especially since the Jedi now held a glowing laser sword in front of him.
I said freeze.
Kitar's voice came over their shared comm channel, just a fraction of a second off from the real-life view she had in her sniper scope. The Jedi emissary stepped back in slow and controlled movements, and though his weapon was still up in a defensive position, his posture showed a complete lack of aggression. Rug had heard plenty about the Jedi Knights, of course. Anyone in any military had. But most of her time in the Neimoidian Special Forces involved Black Ops, usually in the Outer Rim, protecting or sabotaging supply lanes, blockades, and other missions where the needs of Neimoidians and the needs of the Trade Federation overlapped. Which meant it usually didn't involve the more proper nature of the Jedi.
I heard you, and I am abiding, the Jedi said.
A man by the name of Obi-Wan Kenobi, if she remembered correctly from the overheard discussion during their shift earlier today. Nothing official had been passed to them. Guards handling grunt work apparently weren't on a need-to-know basis. Rug held her rifle steady, though she glanced down at the spectrometer at her feet, the small display showing that it had finished processing its chemical residue scan. She reached down and quickly attached it to her belt before returning to the unfolding scene. But he projected his voice out much louder, and despite the lack of light, she saw his silhouette turn her way. I mean you no harm. He spoke directly to her, not Kitar. The Jedi took one hand off his blade's hilt, holding it palm up, then methodically backed up several steps, his angle twisting to likely keep an eye on both Rug and her young partner. Kitar shifted, and in the scope, light from the laser sword reflected lines on his face, a clear hardening underneath the angled brim of his standard guard helmet. I am not your enemy, the Jedi said, this time in a calm and quiet voice meant probably for Kitar. Part of being an elite commando meant reading people, seeing their actions before they happened through any possible ticks or tells. Here, the Jedi offered a calm neutrality. And though this might have been due to their supposed mystical powers, Rue got a hint of sincerity from the situation. Still, nothing was certain, especially not under current galactic circumstances.
It's illegal for anyone to be below the fog without a permit at this time of night, she yelled. Especially in an investigation site.
They stood still. The hum of the Jedi's weapon captured clearly over Kitar's comm channel until the howl of the planet's wildlife broke through. Fog rolled over the wrecked building, though the glowing blade emitted enough light to remain visible in her scope without any thermal vision or other augmented views.
I don't have a permit, the Jedi shouted back, but I am conducting an investigation.
We know who you are,
Kitar growled.
You're here to cover up the evidence of the Republic's sabotage.
He stepped closer, his pistol up, and despite the dim conditions, the barrel of the weapon showed a clear tremble.
You're trying to get away with murder and destruction.
I am on an invest... Liar!
Liar!
The entire cycle of emotions constantly burned through Kitar since their first visit to Katasura, and investigating on the surface didn't change anything. Anger, grief, despair, concentration, and then back again. Right now, the Jedi emissary may have encountered them at the exact wrong moment in the cycle, and Kitar's voice clearly showed where his mind was. After their guard shift today, he'd promised to get some rest before their evening investigation, something she'd offered to Kitar to keep him constructively occupied instead of blasting training droids. Though based on the sudden shift in his demeanor, she had a sneaking suspicion that he'd sought the company of the Separatist agent instead of taking a nap.
You are here too.
Kitar!
She yelled. She knew enough about Jedi to understand that their weapons cut through anything, and if her partner didn't realize that, then she'd fill him in later. For now, she needed to dial down the situation.
Patience. He deserves a moment to speak. You, Jedi, you better have a good reason for being here.
The Jedi glanced her way, a thoughtful look visible through her scope, and his voice carried that through as well.
I am on an investigation on behalf of the Republic, at the invitation of the Trade Federation. I am of the firm belief that this disaster was not caused by the Republic, and my goal is to prove that and find the true culprit.
You were down here earlier with the others.
Kitar shook the pistol at him. He must have talked with Dooku's agent, because even Rug didn't know that.
Why sneak here at night? With no oversight, no official escort?
My investigation.
He searched for the right words, and Rug appreciated the careful consideration being applied here.
My investigation required more time. Given the level of bureaucracy accompanying me, the window for an efficient process was shrinking. It was critical to scan and assess tonight, given the rate of decay for evidence in such a harsh environment.
Bureaucracy. Rube wondered if that meant the Separatist woman. She seemed the troublemaking type.
Do you actually believe this, Jedi?
Kitar yelled over to her. The actual guilty party doesn't matter to me, he continued, maintaining a calm and deliberate voice. I believe the Republic is innocent. But if it turns out to be some unknown faction claiming to serve the Republic, so be it. Or if it was done on behalf of the Separatists. All I want is the truth. And, he paused, then pointed at her with his free hand. I can see you are investigating as well. I watched the way you studied the remains. It appears this is what we both want. So perhaps we can work together.
The hand holding his weapon stretched up in a controlled motion, raising it high for both Nemoidians to see. The shining blue blade quickly snapped back into the hilt, leaving them in near dark. A new light appeared, a personal lamp beaming from Kitar's shoulder that changed the complexion of the scene. A swift change in the shadows caught Rug's eye, enough to show that the switch in light might have caught the attention of something. Rug changed her scope to thermal vision, the clarity of the real world view becoming pixelated, burnt figures against a blue backdrop. The Jedi lowered his hilt to place it on the cool ground of the planet's surface.
I work in good faith.
He raised both hands, then stood and took two steps back. And then she saw it. Her shoulders tensed, locking the rifle into a steadying position, and her finger readied for the right moment, the right shot.
This is a token of...
A flash erupted from Rug's rifle, and through her scope, she watched as the Jedi didn't flinch, didn't even move. The blaster bolt whizzed a meter over him, soon followed by a beastly howl that rang into the night. With that, Rug swung her sniper rifle onto her back and began bounding down, landing on debris that crumbled upon impact and vaulting forward over chunks of broken buildings. She hit the surface floor running, hurtling over obstacles while her focus shifted from the Jedi to the large furry creature with four stumpy legs writhing on the ground, yelping in pain. Had it been upright, it would have towered over Kitar and the Jedi. But here, it needed help.
I need a med pack, she yelled. Kitar, get out some rations as well.
Her feet pounded, dust clouds floating up and mixing into the fog with each step.
and she charged past the Jedi over to the fallen beast.
"Feed it the rations while I patch the wound,"
she yelled, taking the medpack from Keitar in mid-stride. Keitar moved to the animal, its girthy belly heaving with each breath and large ears tilting forward.
"Corgi beasts are gentle, but they get hungry. There you are, girl. We'll get you through this."
It caught the aroma of the rations, and soon it nibbled out of Keitar's hand while Rug addressed the shoulder wound with Bactan laser sutures.
"This whole mess has affected the local wildlife. It's not their fault their food chain has been disrupted. Normally, they're very docile,"
she said as the Jedi came over as well, one hand on the creature's forehead, and seconds later, its whine became a controlled, steady breath.
"They lose their minds a little when they get hungry."
"You're saying I was its dinner?" the Jedi asked.
"Never doubt the appetite of a corgi beast,"
Rug said with a laugh. She moved over, giving it scratches under its neck, loose hairs tossing into the air.
"Or the amount they shed. You're a good girl, aren't you?"
The corgi beast nudged the sniper with its black nose, then looked at the Jedi before Keitar tossed an open ration into the distance. It limped away, the scent of the food drawing it from the trio.
"My name is Obi-Wan Kenobi," he said in a soft voice as he watched the corgi beast trail off into the mists of Cato Neimoidia.
"I am the emissary from the Jedi Order, representing the Republic."
"Rug Quarnom,"
she said, exhaling as she got back on her feet.
"And I have much less exciting credentials than you,
but perhaps more liked by animals.
My enthusiastic friend here is Keitar Nor. I am supposed to be training him."
She gave a short laugh, and Keitar replied with a sour expression. And from Obi-Wan's raised eyebrow, she caught a bit of empathy at the give and take of their relationship.
"Do all guards carry sniper rifles and custom stealth equipment?"
he said, gesturing at her form-fitting maroon-tinted armor.
"If they're good enough."
Rug pointed at the dormant laser sword still sitting on the ground.
"While I certainly believe in the idea of neutrality and independence, I also want the truth."
She picked up the hilt, taking a moment to assess how such a small piece of craftsmanship carried so much energy, even weighed more than she expected.
"And I too believe in good faith," she said, handing the weapon back to its owner.
Obi-Wan took it before nodding in approval, eyes locking with Rug the entire time, though she noticed he avoided the glare coming from Keitar.
Chapter 21, Anakin Skywalker.
Anakin ran, his eyes scanning. His boots thumped against the metal deck plate of the cruiser, passing by as Theo and Sparks addressed a group of the 302nd next to the stacks of Bacta crates slated for distribution down on Langston. Clones prepped the mission, but they wouldn't be any help to him right now. Not unless they'd been babysitting. Still, he asked, and they'd replied with a simple, "Not recently, sir." "Have you seen Mil Alabath? The Zabrak youngling?" Anakin asked another helmetless clone down the hall, who merely shook his head. His search continued, sweeping through the ship's security cams, methodically working his way through. Finally, in a small storage room, he'd located Durbin Wen Hurd, showing off her acrobatic lightsaber techniques with her Shoto blades. She must have run out of ways to entertain them as well. Except Mil wasn't with them. "Where's Mil?" Anakin asked, the question coming out more like a demand than he'd intended.
"She is meditating,"
Durbin said, after landing from a gravity-defying sprint along the wall. She withdrew both her blue and green blades, then tossed her long hair back, adjusting the large glare-reducing spectacles strapped around her head.
"Storage room off the main corridor."
"Master Wen Hurd! Master Wen Hurd!"
The younglings yelled in unison, leading to a sigh that caused Anakin to smirk. It was her turn to deal with this. Of course, Mill's meditation corner happened to be the last place Anakin looked. And by the time he found her, his breath paced at a light huff. He took a moment to center himself, both physically and mentally, then spoke to the meditating youngling. "Mill?" he asked softly.
"Master?"
she said, opening her eyes. "Are you connecting with the Force? I didn't sense any disruptions."
"Trying to let it in. But it's more like keeping it at bay."
Her gaze dropped to the floor.
"There's a lot of talk about battles here. I have something to show you. You should come with me."
With that, Anakin turned, his robe swirling with the movement, and he motioned her forward. "We have to catch the transport before it goes." She sprinted to catch up, then tried to match his steps, except he marched with focus, so much that he didn't realize she lagged until they were halfway to the launch bay. Not only did she struggle to keep up with him, she also stayed quiet the entire time, awaiting instructions. Of course, the younglings trusted him on a level beyond Padawan's.
"We're going to the surface. I was just about to head out when I got an idea."
The hallway led out into the loud launch bay, shuttles awaiting loading as troops jogged back and forth or pulled supplies or checked weapons.
"What's that, Master?"
"Listen," Anakin said, kneeling down to look at her face to face. "I understand how you feel. I was brought to the Order when I was a boy, not a baby. I had a life, friends, my mother. It's a little different from what you've been through, but..." He exhaled, trying to find the right words to connect with her. "I understand that conflict. What you feel like when you're being pulled in different directions. The way you feel the Force, but you hear it differently than what they tell you at the temple. And that's scary. It makes you want to hide from it. I understand all of it."
The last few days flashed through his mind, from the joyride with Padme to his talks with Obi-Wan and the Chancellor, the most important people in his life.
"I'm still seeking my path, but I thought getting you on the surface might help you see with your own eyes, to witness the different ways the Jedi serve the Republic. It's not just lightsabers and fighting."
He flagged down the trooper leading this particular transport, a clone known as Sister, that he'd met on assignment shortly after the secret wedding. She took off her helmet, rows of tightly braided hair falling down over her armored shoulders.
"We're loaded up, General. The supplies are already on the surface. We've just got to distribute them. Hop aboard when you're ready," she said.
Sister pointed to the clone troopers waiting in the transport's open hull, standing still in a line. R2-D2 rolled up to them, beeping chirps of annoyance.
"Your droid is impatient, sir."
"Yeah."
He reached out to gently tap R2-D2 on the dome.
"He gets that way."
He turned back to Mill.
"So what do you think? Up for a ride?"
Mill looked at the transport. Anakin traced her gaze and saw it locking directly on the clones.
"We're not soldiers. Why are we leading them?"
Despite her question, she took a step forward. R2-D2 scooted alongside her and Anakin walked to keep pace. Sister put her helmet back on, lights reflecting off its magenta and blue vertical stripes. Then she gave them quick salutes, which Mill tried to imitate in return. Such a question had never come into his thoughts before, perhaps because he'd simply gotten thrown into the fray at Geonosis. In fact, it seemed like many Jedi fell into immediate lockstep with the clones, the war demanding so much of them that no one pondered who they were, why they were here. What little he knew of the clones came from the battlefield, though he'd found them to be intelligent, loyal, and often funny. In many ways, anything unlike what he expected.
Try not to think of them as soldiers or clones. In many ways, they're just like you and me, trying to do some good in the galaxy the best way they know how. Now, he said as she looked up to him, let's go help some people.
Chapter 22, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Despite their rocky start, Roog led Obi-Wan to new areas to investigate, going far beyond the massive struts that marked severance points, all the way to areas that showed collateral damage from the initial blasts. She pointed out irregularities in the blast radius, how the struts splintered differently, evidence that could mean several different things about the types of explosive compounds used. She also pulled out her own data pad of compiled evidence, including material traces that had since evaporated into the fog and wind of Cato Nemordia's surface. That, along with his own accumulated scans and sensor readings, gave him an entire day's worth of material to comb through, and unfortunately, no Republic computers for processing. But he'd figure that out later. The entire time, Kitar stayed silent, an air of suspicion coming from him while they talked. In their fourth hour of investigation, Obi-Wan knew his body was reaching the point of physical exhaustion. I do not know much about Nemordian sleep cycles, Obi-Wan said, but I should return and get some rest soon, if I'm going to be of any use tomorrow.
That's not a bad idea, Roog said.
She held up a small vial and poured its contents over the mix of metal, concrete, and stone, something that appeared to be a chunk of strut blown into the side of a building. It bubbled, releasing a neon-yellow mixture through the air, visible just enough for her to hold up a scanner to it.
Chemical reaction. I'll send over the results once it finishes.
You've done good work without holding a proper lab with you, Obi-Wan said, scrolling through his data pad.
I may not have any of your Jedi powers, but experience does close the gap in some scenarios.
Kitar,
she said, handing him a device out of her armor's chest pocket.
Run process 4C on this with an exposure time of 6 seconds.
Understood,
the young guard said. He brushed past Obi-Wan as if he weren't even there, then began tapping on his data pad.
Surely you didn't learn all about chemistry and explosives in basic training,
Obi-Wan said. Though Kitar stood behind Obi-Wan, he knew the comment caught the guard's attention.
I'm just a guard,
Roog said, standing up to stretch her back.
Trying to teach people like Kitar why our work matters.
That is a guard uniform? Roog squinted at her data pad, though from the way her head tilted, he guessed she considered his question more than her scanner's results.
You're inquisitive, Jedi. Part of the job.
Roog let out a quick laugh.
This,
she patted her maroon body armor,
was part of the job, too. Nemordian special ops. Explosives, infiltration, sniper. But now, just a guard.
She put away the last of her devices and nodded toward their shuttle.
Looking for a quieter life? Not necessarily. But sometimes important people think you should be quieter. And there are various ways to accomplish that.
They walked in silence, the only sound coming from the crunch of dirt and debris beneath their boots.
It sounds like you are not satisfied with the Nemordian involvement with the Trade Federation,
Obi-Wan said. An honest comment, but given how accommodating Roog had been over the last few hours, the words came as their own form of bait.
Ah, that's a very, binary view of things. You Jedi do enjoy your rules.
Obi-Wan bit his lip at that, and rather than be defensive, he decided to let Roog continue.
I believe in the idea of the Trade Federation. When the Republic fails to recognize your homeworld as anything but an asset in shipping and commerce, you become a commodity and a statistic. I'll not let my life be a line item in a shipping manifest. With the Trade Federation, Nemordians finally have a voice.
History shows the Republic barely acknowledged our existence until the Trade Federation. The way governments operate, though, that always changes.
Kitar spoke up, perhaps for the first time in an hour.
Why shouldn't we support the separatist cause? We know our worth, and it's much more than the Republic claims.
Obi-Wan caught a hint of a smile on Rug's face, though she clearly tried to hide it.
We're not talking about the separatists here. Cato Ne Moidia is neutral, Rug said. The Trade Federation is neutral.
Neutrality in the face of oppression is further oppression,
Kitar said, which Obi-Wan agreed with to some degree, but probably from the opposite perspective as Kitar.
Is it oppression, or is it independence? A freedom to choose,
Rug asked, almost like a teacher leading a student to an epiphany. But Kitar hesitated, the bite to his attitude settling as he considered the question. They walked a few more steps in silence before Obi-Wan spoke up, despite the fact that the question wasn't directed at him.
I would say it depends on context,
he offered. Something for both of them to consider in different ways. They both looked at him, though with very different points of view written on their expressions and postures.
I agree, Rug said. Context defines everything.
I have a friend who thinks like you, Obi-Wan said, the smirk on his face probably not visible in the dim Cato Ne Moidian night.
I can believe in the Trade Federation without liking its leadership over the past 10 years, and I can recognize the systemic issues within the Republic, but still